Tech Talk on RNIB Connect Radio.
Hello and a very warm welcome to Tech Talk, RNIB Connect Radio's regular look at the world of accessible technology from a blindness and partially sighted perspective. I'm your host, Dave Williams. Don't forget, of course, Tech Talk, it's your program and we'd love to know what you're thinking about technology. You can, of course, drop us a line with a tip, question, a review, a demonstration, whatever you like. That email address, it's techtalk@rnib.org.uk. Coming up this time, we'll be hearing from the team behind the WeWalk Smart Cane. Callum Stoneman tries out alt text to make his social media posts more accessible, and we'll be hearing about how RNIB is getting more involved with accessible gaming. Welcome in our co-hosts, Callum Stoneman and Tasneem Arshad. How are you both?
Hello, I'm very good, thanks.
Very good, thank you.
What's grabbing your attention in the world of technology this week?
I've recently discovered that iOS does alternative calendars. So you've got the Chinese calendar, the Hebrew calendar, and the Islamic calendar. So I thought that was quite interesting.
I wouldn't be without, you know, that's a really good tip. And the other thing that is, I think, underrated is the whole notion of a shared calendar.
Yes.
You know, myself and my wife, we have a shared calendar. Do you share your calendar, Callum?
Yes, me and my wife have one as well. And it's a constant, I say me and my wife have one. It's basically my wife puts things on there and then that's her way of basically saying to me, don't forget about this. And I'll still forget. She's the organized one in our relationship.
Okay, well, we may return to the subject of accessible calendars in a future week. But for now, Callum Stoneman, Tasneem Arshad, strap yourself in. It's another episode of Tech Talk.
WeWalk is a smart cane that has been around for a few years, and they've recently secured another £1.5 million of funding. So what does that mean for the future of the smart cane and the future of their product? Well, David Hogg is up next to tell us more.
Now, you may remember, a wee while ago, we spoke to Jean-Marc Fagali from WeWalk about their smart cane. Well, recently, they've raised over £1.5 million in funding. So today, he's back. Jean, thank you so much for joining us here on RNIB Connect Radio.
It's my pleasure to be here, David. Thanks for having me on.
No problem at all. So for those who don't know, can you tell us just briefly what the WeWalk Smart Cane is?
Of course. So WeWalk is a team of people with professional and lived experience of visual impairment and disability. And we're just on a mission to empower people who struggle with independent mobility to finally have that independent mobility. And the way that we wanted to do that to begin with is through revolutionizing the standard white cane, which we all know and love. We think the white cane's a great device. But we thought we could do more, especially in considering obstacle detection and smartphone connectivity. And that's exactly what we did. So we built the WeWalk Smart Cane to get visually impaired people from point A to point B safely, effectively, and independently. Quite a simple concept, really. We've taken the standard white cane, we've chopped off the rubber handle that sits on top of it, and we've replaced it with the WeWalk handle, which has all the tech bits inside. It's got an ultrasonic sensor for things like upper body obstacle detection, for low-hanging tree branches and signposts. But where we go further is we've got the patented connectivity to our WeWalk smartphone application, which we've built from the ground up in conjunction with our visually impaired community to make it one of the most accessible navigation and exploration applications out there. So with your app, you can get walking directions, clock directions, destination tracking. It'll tell you about your nearest bus stop, nearest train stop, the stops on that journey, and when the next transport vehicle is arriving. And we even have an exploration mode. So WeWalk will tell you about nearby businesses like your local restaurant, cafe, or library. And the thing is, once you connect the two together, you can control this entire experience through voice, through the built-in touchpad, speaker, and microphone on the WeWalk handle, so you can leave your smartphone in your pocket and get that enhanced navigation.
Now, you said last time you were on that WeWalk, the app and the platform, is constantly changing, constantly evolving. So in that past year, how has the WeWalk experience changed?
An absolutely huge amount, particularly in our software. So our dev teams have been working really hard. And actually, at the end of last year, we partnered up with MoveIt to enhance our public transport integration. And WeWalk now has a complete multimodal navigation system. And what that means is it will literally dissect your journey into different transport modes, be it walking, bus, or train. And then we'll handhold you through each of those journeys. So if it's walking navigation, you'll be led via walk. And once you get to the bus stop, it'll intelligently switch to that stop, let you know when your specific vehicle is arriving. And then on that vehicle, it'll help you get off. Another thing is we've been working hard on our R&D partnerships. Particularly in looking at the use of new and emerging technology in our device. And that's been a big thing for us. It's helped us continue our project with Imperial College London and the RNIB. We were working together previously for about 18 months on looking at indoor navigation for WeWalk, doing some tests over at Imperial College, thanks to user requirements derivation from the RNIB. But now that we have a follow-on project, which has just been announced, the press embargo's lifted, we've got an even more exciting collaboration ahead of us both. So we're guaranteed to be working together for the next 2 years, starting actually earlier this May. And we're looking at building the future of WeWalk as a project consortium, leveraging user feedback and customer insights from the RNIB and the RNIB teams, as well as Imperial College's expertise in navigation. You know, how do we make WeWalk the most accurate navigation device out there, leveraging things like cameras, computer vision, and situational awareness. So we haven't just been building the existing product, but thanks to the RNIB and actually to our visually impaired community who feed into the RNIB and who help us build our data sets, we now have the future of WeWalk that's also in the works as a project consortium.
Really exciting stuff there to see just how it's evolved over that past year and how it can evolve further. Now, as mentioned in the introduction, you've recently raised about £1.5 million of funding. What are you planning on doing with that, and how is it going to help WeWalk get to the next level?
That's a really great question. Now, first off, I want to say a massive thank you to absolutely everyone that participated in our fundraising. I mean, part of that fundraising was through Crowdcube. We didn't just want to open this up to institutional investors or angels who have been tremendously supportive, but also the general public. We wanted people to feel like they had a piece of WeWalk with them. You know, in the end, we are built by the insights of our community. And so massive, massive thank you for believing in us and for pledging to support us through the investment raise. The reasons why we've raised the investment are twofold. Firstly, it's to continue developing our product. We know that our work is still cut out. I mean, WeWalk, yes, we know we've made improvements. We know it has helped people, but it is not a perfect product. There's no such thing as a perfect product. We're going to keep expanding the day-to-day feature set of WeWalk, adding more expandability in our navigation, our exploration modes, our public transport, just making it better. You know, WeWalk plus, 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 plus. But at the same time, we realize that we want to reach visually impaired people with a broad set of requirements and perhaps at different price points. Perhaps visually impaired people that might not need hardware, or visually impaired people that want certain features only within their WeWalk experience. And so we're going to be looking at not just new pricing models or new ways of getting WeWalks into people's hands, but also looking at global distribution channels and sales teams to make sure that once a user does actually have WeWalk, they then have a good feedback mechanism or feedback channel, if you'd like, for them to talk to us about their experiences, how WeWalk has helped them, and of course, most importantly, how we can keep improving our product, especially in things like different languages and different regions and different price. So we're just going to be doing more of what we do. This has just secured the company's future. It's allowed us to keep building and experimenting with new technology. But at the same time, it helps us keep building our after-sales support, as well as capturing that very, very valuable product feedback. And because of that fundraising, it's why we have partnerships like Imperial and the RNIB. It just gives us the freedom to do more for our community.
And finally, if any of our listeners want to keep up with all things WeWalk, then where can they do that?
So yeah, you can keep up to date with WeWalk on all of our social channels, which is WeWalk.io on Instagram and Twitter. We also have our YouTube page where we put out product demos, what's coming up next, and basically anything interesting to do with visual impairment. And actually, we also have within our WeWalk app, the WeWalk 101 section, if you're a WeWalk user, where we'll keep adding new voice notes for our new features, as well as the WeWalk Academy. So yeah, do stay in touch if you're an interested customer, would like to get to know more about WeWalk, or just curious as to what your fellow visually impaired colleagues are up to in the field of tech, then we're more than open to have an open discussion.
Well, John from WeWalk, thank you so much for joining us here on RNIB Connect Radio.
Thanks for having me, David.
Callum Stoneman, you're a guide dog user, but that doesn't mean that you never use a cane, because, of course, if your guide dog's, you know, unavailable or got a hangover or something, then you might need to dust off the cane. Does the idea of a smart cane appeal to you?
I'm not sure. I'm torn on this because, yeah, you're right. I'm a guide dog owner, so I barely use my cane. I do have it, and obviously I do have the cane skills. You've got to have them in order to have a guide dog. But yeah, I mean, I'm not a confident cane user anyway. So I do feel like maybe some of the smart things in this could maybe kind of boost my confidence a bit, because I do feel a lot more confident with the dog than I do with the cane. And maybe if I've got the cane there giving me directions and, you know, the sort of things that this can do, maybe that would improve my confidence a bit. But for me, I'm a bit, I don't know, it's a lot of money just for a cane. And for me personally, I think there's a lot of things that I've already got on my smartphone, such as, you know, Soundscape and things like that, that it seems, from what I've heard, it seems to do similar things. I'm interested to try it out. I've never been able to get hands-on with this and have a play with it. So, you know, I'd probably think differently if I actually felt this in action and maybe had a couple of days with it or did a couple of routes with it. But yeah, I'm a bit torn because it feels like a lot of money. And then, you know, my question with all these things is, will they be looked after? Will they be maintained? Or if they're suddenly not supported anymore, or you've suddenly got to pay another £1,000 for the WeWalk version 2, as opposed to, you know, £50 or £40 or even less for just a new cane tip. I know which one sounds more appealing to me, so undecided is the short answer.
Tasneem Arshad, how do you feel about smart canes? Would you be more likely to feel more confident with a smart cane?
Potentially. I mean, similarly to Callum, really, I think cost implications are huge. So not everybody will be able to afford a gadget like this. I think I would love to have a trial with it for a week and then I'd be able to give a more balanced opinion on it. I've read a lot around it. It's got some interesting features. I'm unsure about what happens when the technology goes wrong. If you're out and about doing a route, you're relying on the features that, you know, a bit like your sat-nav, if you were driving and it kind of just completely disappeared, how would you then get around? It'd go back to being a normal cane, presumably, and you could still get along to your destination. So I'll be interested to know how they're fixing their bugs or what challenges they've come across, really, to see how they've overcome those barriers and what's available in the technology to do that. If it's, you know, whatever technology, if it's using LiDAR, if it's using something else, how are those problems and challenges going to be overcome if you're en route and the technology fails?
Yeah, I agree.
Important to recognise, I think, with any technology, it's augmentative, isn't it? It doesn't replace your core mobility skills. Clearly, the cane would still work as a cane if the technology's not working, in the same way that you wouldn't stop driving if the GPS stopped talking. So very important to recognise that it is augmentative and, you know, add something extra. Were you going to come in there, Callum?
I was just going to say, yeah, I agree. The last thing that I'd want is to be rushing out of the door, grab my cane, turn it on, and then it's there going, oh, your cane needs a software update. There's something quite funny about that for me, but for something as crucial as a cane, yeah, you wouldn't want something like that. So it'd be interesting to know how they're overcoming things like that.
Yes. Well, watch this space, and maybe we can try and get hold of a cane from WeWalk, and you could take it for a spin. Let us know your thoughts about a smart cane. Would you like one? Would you want one? Are you like me and leave it in a taxi or a pub? We would love to know. techtalk@rnib.org.uk. Now, we've spoken at length about accessible gaming on Tech Talk previously, and some of you, of course, prefer specialist games that are made just for you. Others are willing to battle away with mainstream games and try to make those more accessible. And for people like me, I do find the world of gaming little bit mysterious. So somebody who I hope is going to help us navigate this space both today and in the future is Sightless Combat himself, Mr. Ben Breen. A very warm welcome to Tech Talk, Ben, and welcome to RNIB. Fantastic to have you with us.
Thank you so much for the opportunity. Hi, I am Ben. Most of you may know me as Sightless Combat. I was an accessibility consultant, but now I'm the Accessible Gaming and Immersive Technologies Research Officer here at RNIB. Yes, that is a very long title and one that I've had to abbreviate into a shortcut in Outlook so I don't have to get repetitive strain injury from typing it all the time. But yeah, I've been playing video games for longer than I can remember, and audio-only games as well, for those of you who are you know, interested in that particular genre. And I am now, you know, in terms of my role, my, you know, essentially what I was doing before, so accessibility consultancy, working with studios, working with publishers, anyone who'll listen, really, as well as, you know, working on research into, you know, to, you know, raise awareness of, you know, the need for improvements in the landscape such as it is at the current time, but also with end goals, including but not limited to essentially getting more people with sight loss involved in, you know, testing, user testing and things like that. So the things that I've had opportunities to do and give feedback to developers from, you know, get more people involved in that. But of course, I am very new to the role at this point.
Let's dial it back a little bit, Ben, and get a bit more of a sense of you, and then we'll talk more about gaming and the role at RNIB and so on. I notice on your website you describe yourself as a GWS, a gamer without sight. Is that right?
Yes, that is correct. And the only reason I really had to start doing that was around confusion on terminology, essentially, because with a lot of different terms for varying degrees of vision floating around, people still said, you know, if I said to people, I have no sight whatsoever, you know, or I said, you know, I'm a blind gamer or whatever, people would still get confused and say, how much can you see? So I ended up starting to have to say to people, look, I am a gamer without sight. It is what it says on the tin. I have no sight whatsoever. And occasionally I'll get people still asking me, but you know, they mostly understand. So it was really out of necessity that I started having to do it. So yeah, but it's a turn of phrase that stuck. Other people have sort of gone with it as well, to an extent. They, you know, they'll agree that they are gamers without sight as well. So it's good to have a you know, a definition, a clear line, as it were, for people to understand.
Yeah, and it's a legitimate question as well, isn't it? That 93% of people who are, you know, registered as blind or partially sighted actually have some kind of, you know, light perception or useful vision. So it's a legitimate question, I think. Let's sort of go back to the beginning. So where did your gaming journey start then?
My gaming journey started many, many years ago mostly with PC games, actually. This was before I really knew what screen readers were or anything like that. Playing games like Fighter Pilot, and it wasn't so much I knew what I was doing, it was really just press buttons and, you know, see what happens and be like, what does this do, and promptly nosediving a plane into literally unseen territory. So that was always rather amusing. Then I graduated, for lack of a better term, to audio games. The first audio game I can vividly remember was Grizzly Gulch Western Extravaganza, a title those of you old enough to remember will know was a pretty rudimentary 4 or 5 key adventure game, if you include the space bar, that had you wandering around the eponymous town of Grizzly Gulch and getting involved in gambling, gunfights and bribery. All great things to get involved in at a very young age.
Indeed, yeah. And I remember Grizzly Gulch, and that was a specialist title that was developed with blind gamers in mind. Thinking about your PC games, so what was the appeal for you, Ben, engaging in something which, let's be honest, is ostensibly a visual pursuit for many people? A lot of games are kind of visual first, and so what kind of drew you to that?
I'm not really sure. Maybe just you know, the sound design, the music. Not that I really knew what sound design and music were at this point. It was just a matter of, you know, cool things are happening when I'm pressing the buttons. But then, of course, you know, later on, I graduated into console gaming, mainly because, you know, the sighted people I knew didn't really get audio games at all, and they didn't see the value in it because there were no graphics. And that I can, you know, understand to an extent. You know, I've seen people be like, oh, you know, but I can't see anything on the screen. And I'm like, that's kind of the point. So, you know, I ended up playing, you know, fighting games on, you know, PlayStation 1, and then going forward from there, you know, fast forward to now where fighting games are still a thing I end up playing occasionally, but not as much. Partly because they're really kind of a stereotype now. You know, blind people play fighting games, and that's mostly what people think of. But also, you know, my interests have moved onwards, upwards, however you want to look at it, to more sort of action adventure, narrative driven, you know, combat oriented titles, really. Things like God of War, things like Last of Us Part 2, things like Spider-Man and Miles Morales, Uncharted, Ratchet and Clank. I could go on. But also, of course, there's the multiplayer side of it, where over the years I've met loads and loads of great people, particularly over the, you know, since I've been doing my consultancy work, as it was then, in games like Sea of Thieves, Gears 5, Minecraft Dungeons, even the Forza series to a limited extent. There's been a lot of great interactions I've had with sighted people who just don't necessarily understand that you can game without sight. And then once they get it, they're like, wow, how do you do that? So it's always great to be able to break the ice and kind of throw the book at people and be like, this is how this works for me, because that's the key thing. Every person plays differently, and every person believes games should be played a different way, or the way they work best for them. So, for instance, you were saying about people battling through mainstream games, I believe was your wording. You know, there are a lot of people who believe in brute forcing a game with patience, OCR, and, you know, doing it all on their own terms, which I can completely understand. But personally, I don't necessarily think that's as fun or fun at all in certain cases. So I put my time into either collaborating with people who have sight and are willing to work through games with me, or playing games that have enough workable accessibility that I can, you know, do most of it possibly. So, you know, the combat in God of War is probably 90% doable, other than the few call-outs you need for when, you know, unblockable attacks are coming in. So even though the traversal is being handled by a sighted person, and maybe by me to an extent, the combat is pretty much all me. And that is, you know, where I get my enjoyment from. So it's all different lenses and perspectives, really.
I used to, as a kid, and I suspect you might be a little bit younger than me, Ben, I used to struggle to play Daley Thompson's Super Test on the Spectrum.
Oh, wow, yeah.
Yeah, games like that. And Outrun. I remember that game from my youth. Mummy, I think, was a game where you had to kind of walk around pyramids, which were represented by little squares on the screen. You know, and of course things like, you know, Space Invaders and that kind of stuff. And I really wanted to play those games as a kid because I wanted to feel included. You know, I wanted to be able to talk with my sighted friends about the game and feel like I was on a level playing field. And I really wasn't, and I really didn't feel that I was ever going to be able to get much enjoyment, you know, no matter how much I waggled that joystick in the ski jump on Daley Thompson Super Test. I just had no idea when to press the fire button, which was when you're supposed to jump, you know, and I would always end up rolling into a snowball or whatever it was. So how do you make it a level playing field? I mean, was it about social inclusion for you, or was it the kind of the geeky, the technology, the sound effects and all that stuff?
I think it was probably a combination, really. I think in terms of that, it was definitely, you know, a matter of being included. I remember, you know, friends of mine many years ago would be like, oh, I did this raid in World of Warcraft. And I was like, I'd love to be able to join you, but I can't. You know, so there's definitely an element of that. And even now, that comes into play. So there's an event going on at the moment that I would love to be involved in. I'm actually part of the Xbox Ambassadors. So, you know, a big worldwide network of, well, individuals and communities as well, who, you know, play on Xbox or Windows 10 or, you know, any platform, really. But there's a big event going on at the moment with, you know, multiplayer as kind of a focus to an extent. Of course, there are single player games included. But the fact of the matter is, a lot of the games, I looked at the list or where I could, and a lot of the games weren't actually accessible. So things like Fortnite, Fall Guys, so all these big popular games that everybody else is enjoying, having fun with, you know, passing the time with, not only on their own, but with friends. I can't enjoy those. So it's a shame because, you know, this is 2022. The industry has moved forward significantly, even in the last, you know, 7 or so years. that I've been, you know, doing consultancy work. I've been writing reviews. I've been streaming on YouTube and Twitch and other platforms as well. But it's not moved forward enough. And I think that's what it is. It's not so much it's about social inclusion for me. It's about being able to, you know, enjoy the same games as everybody else, which is arguably the same thing, but it's not quite at that point yet at all where that can happen. And that's what I'm, that's what keeps me going and motivated to make this work, because we should all be able to enjoy the same games as everyone else. And, you know, regardless of what level of sight you have. And that's just not there yet.
At what point did you go from being a gamer without sight to becoming an advocate? Because you've written extensively on your website. I think there are around 75 reviews of games from an accessibility perspective. You've written extensively about the techniques that you use, the sound cues, the bits where you might need sighted assistance, and all of that. When did you really sort of become that? Because you're sort of quite high profile, your visibility on social media, and, you know, you mentioned YouTube and Twitch and other platforms. I think I've seen you on Twitter. So when did you just sort of start the advocacy piece, and what sort of drove you to start wanting to share your experiences as a game without sight so that other people could learn and benefit from what you had discovered?
So it was around the time the PlayStation beta leak happened for the PlayStation 4, where they said, oh, we're going to get text-to-speech, and then it had little asterisks at the bottom saying, oh, it's only for certain models and certain hardware and in certain countries and whatnot. It was around that sort of time, not exactly then, but I realized there was a niche that wasn't being covered. So I was watching all these unboxing videos and seeing, you know, oh, here's this amazing thing, but they wouldn't describe anything. They wouldn't say how they were unboxing it or anything like that. I'm not quite sure exactly why that popped into my head, but the general idea was, you know, I could write reviews that, you know, from my perspective, you know, having no sight, because that's not a perspective I'd seen covered. And the second thought that came into my head was essentially, if I get one of these products, you know, like I've ordered it online and it comes through Amazon or Microsoft or whoever I get it from, the fact of the matter is, you know, I want to know how I unbox this without any assistance. So I want to know what's in the box, how things plug in, how you turn it all on, how you use it, any issues that there might be with, you know, the tech inside of it, any of that kind of stuff. So it was all a part of covering that. And I started with accessory reviews rather than games, because getting hold of game codes, you know, having no prior real experience of how to do it was difficult. But I managed to get in contact with a few companies. I started reaching out, said, hi, I want to review stuff from an accessibility point of view. There were definitely people who were interested, which was great. And they sent me products to review. And I started doing it, putting it up on my website, realized I needed a place to host it. So then, you know, went and found an accessible hosting provider, which was a great idea. And I'm still with that provider as of the time of this recording. And, you know, it was really a matter of, well, kind of advocating and giving the feedback to the teams who needed it as well, where I could. So say I had a contact directly at a company, I would then send the review and say, hey, here's the link to my review. Let me know what you think. And the consultancy side of it really started a couple of years later, where having built that experience up of reviewing and publishing videos and, you know, mostly gameplay of Killer Instinct at that point, which was a big part of my, you know, my YouTube career, for lack of a better word, I got to undertake a Winston Churchill Traveling Fellowship. And that was a funded opportunity to fly around the States for 5 weeks to write a report, which then became Exploring Accessibility in the Video Game Industry Through Studio Practices. And that was a big discussion, you know, with various people. So I went to my first E3, the Electronic Entertainment Expo, so the big trade show that used to run each year and is returning next year, from what I understand, to an in-person event. And, you know, I went to go to E3, I went to go to Valve, so the big PC gaming platform, to Microsoft. I did a Q&A there. So I've talked, you know, Nvidia, even the graphics card manufacturer, which you might not expect is a thing that needs to happen in terms of a discussion, given I have no sight and graphics are not as useful to me as you might think in that respect. But you need a graphics card to run video games on a PC. Whether you've got sight or not, you need graphics hardware. So being able to explain that and, you know, share my point of view with Nvidia was great there, you know, amongst many other people. So that was where the consultancy really started. I got to talk to to studios. I have contacts from that point, you know, even to now, who I've spoken to. And so, you know, it was almost a two-part journey. So, you know, part one was writing those reviews, putting it all up there, trying to share it where I could, eventually having stuff picked up by, like, Microsoft when I did the Gears of War 4 review for the Xbox One S limited edition that they very kindly sent me. And then, you know, getting to talk to people like Logitech, to Microsoft, Sony, to Valve, you know, all of these people I would have talked to in my fellowship and beyond, from there to get into the actual direct feedback stage of it to studios, if that makes sense.
We'll be hearing more from Ben Breen, also known as Sightless Combat, a little bit later on.
Here's Callum Stoneman telling you more about how you can make social media more accessible using alt text.
In the case of most social media platforms nowadays, the apps themselves tend to be pretty accessible. But a big deal breaker with accessibility on social media is the content that's posted on there. And of course, a lot of that content is posted by users. And if people are uploading photos and videos, which is a huge part of social media, and not adding these descriptions or alt text as they're known, then it could be the most accessible app in the world, but we're still going to struggle to understand that content and make the most of that content. And the social media platforms themselves have tried to come up with other ways to get around this and to resolve this issue, and most of the time they do work pretty well. A big part of that is AI. So if you're on Facebook, for example, you'll know that it often does the image may contain two people indoors smiling. It will try and give you a brief description. It will try and give you some key points. But really, the best option for this is for the users to add descriptions themselves, because then they can, you know, it's a human describing the image and they can describe it however they want to. So let's have a look at how you actually do that. We're going to look at two platforms here, and we're in the Twitter app at the minute, but we're going to look at Twitter and Facebook because they're the platforms that I tend to use the most. And this is available on other platforms as well. I know Instagram has this as well. And we're going to look at the native apps, so the native Twitter and native Facebook app. Other third-party apps for these social media platforms may also allow you to add these descriptions, but you'll just have to check with them. So at the minute, we're on Twitter. The way we're going to do this, because I want to demonstrate the difference when you're reading tweets as well. I want to demonstrate the difference between an image that has alt text and the one that doesn't. So we're going to send out two tweets at the same time, and we're going to attach the same image to both of them. But the first one isn't going to have any alt text. The second one is going to have alt text. It might sound a bit confusing, but bear with me. I'll explain it as we go. So we're in the Twitter app, and let's just find the compose tweet button.
Esther raised fist, compose tweet button.
Okay, double tap.
Actions available. What's happening? Text field is editing. Character mode. Insertion point at start.
Now this is the text field to enter the text of the tweet itself. So to speed things up, I'm just going to dictate this and hopefully it will work. Just recording a demo of Twitter's alt text feature, full stop. This first image does not have alt text.
Inserted, just recording a demo of Twitter is alt text feature. This first image does not have alt text.
Okay, it's close enough. We're going to delete this tweet soon afterwards anyway. So that will do. And we're now going to find the photo library button to add a photo.
Everyone can reply. Voice recording. Photo library. Button.
There it is.
Cancel. Button. All photo. Add. Dim. Camera. Button. Portrait. Photo. The 10th of August, 2022, at 11:28.
That's the photo that I want to add, so I'll just double tap that.
Selected. Portrait. Add. All photo. Add. Button.
Add that to the tweet.
Text field. Is editing. Just recording a demo of Twitter is alt text feature. This first image does not image.
Right. So the image is attached to the tweet. And then if we scroll through these options.
Delete photo. Button. Add a description to this photo. Button.
There's the button that we want. Add a description to this photo. Now, we're not going to do that just yet because this first one is going to have it without the alt text. So we'll carry on down to add another tweet.
Edit photo. Who's in the ad look? Every voice. Photo. GIF. Poll. Tweet. Locate. Characters. Add another tweet. Button. Add another tweet. Text field is editing. Character mode.
So again, we've got the text field for the tweet itself, and this is going to send out, as I said, two tweets at the same time. So we'll just dictate again. This second photo does have alt text.
inserted this second photo does have alt text.
Okay. Now we're going to look for the photo library button again.
Delete we every voice recording photo library button. Cancel button.
And we're going to select that same photo.
All add camera portrait lap portrait photo selected portrait photo the 10th of August 2022.
That's the right one.
Add all photo add button.
Add
text field is editing.
And now we're going to find the add description to this photo button.
Delete we image delete for add a description to this photo button.
That's what we want. So we'll double tap.
Add descriptions heading. You can add a description, sometimes called alt text, to your photos so they are accessible to even more people, including those who are blind or low vision. Good descriptions are concise, but present what's in your photos accurately enough to understand their context.
Okay, so we've got a bit of info of what alt text is there. Remember, of course, this is mainly aimed at sighted users, you know, who might not know what alt text is, but they're the sort of people that we want to be able to add this.
Sure, button, no, thanks. Button.
So that's all we've got on the screen. So that first bit is just giving you more info about a description and basically saying, do you want to add one? So we'll click sure.
Sure. Button. Describe this photo. Text field is editing. Character mode. Insertion point at start.
And now we've got a describe this photo text field. And unlike normal Twitter, where you've only got 280 characters, you've got 1,000 characters for alt text, which is really good if particularly an organisation is posting, for example, advertising an event, you know, and they're posting like a poster or something. A lot of the time, because of Twitter's character limit, and because it looks better, I guess, they will put an image of that poster. But often, you know, it wouldn't be described, which means therefore we lose out on that content. But because there's 1,000 characters here, there should be quite a lot of flexibility. So we'll just add a quick description here. A photo of Callum smiling at the camera.
Inserted a photo of Callum smiling at the camera.
Okay, so that's added.
Done button.
And then flick to the left, we've got a done button.
Text field is editing. This second photo does have alt text. Character mode.
Okay, so that's these two tweets ready to go. And we're just going to send these.
Cancel. Tweet all. Button.
Tweet all, that's what we want.
Account menu. Button. Twitter notification. Your tweets were sent.
There we go. So now if we go to my profile.
Account menu. Profile. Button. Your profile.
And we're just going to look at these two tweets so then you can hear the difference.
Callum Stoneman. Just recording a demo of Twitter is alt text feature. This first image does not have alt text. Image. 22 seconds ago, one reply. Actions okay. Available.
It says there's a reply there because we technically replied to our own tweet. But notice how that just said image. Didn't give you a description. It just read the tweet and then said image. If we flick back and have a listen to the other one.
Callum Stoneman. This second photo does have alt text. Image. A photo of Callum smiling at the camera, 43 seconds ago. Actions
and there
available.
You go. That says image and then tells us the description that we just put in there. So a much more accessible, obviously image doesn't tell you anything, but when you get image and then that description, then that tells you exactly what it is. Strictly speaking, we didn't need a photo of there if we're talking about concise descriptions, but hopefully it gets the point across. If we now flick over to Facebook and have a look at how it works there, I'm not going to post this one because it basically works the same way as Twitter. So it'll say photo and then instead of your just usual image may contain one person, blah, 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 you'll just get the description that's been added. But let's just have a look at how this actually works. So if we flick over to the Facebook app.
Facebook.
And we're going to look for create post.
Stories tray. Create photo post button.
Create photo post. There we go. Straight into the photo library with that one. So we'll double tap that.
Choose layout. Button. Photo. The 10th of August, 2020.
Let's just select that photo.
Selected. One of one. Done. Button.
Click done.
Done. Choose effect. Heading. Close layout options. Button.
Now we're just going to get rid of that because we don't want to add an effect. So we'll just close that little panel there.
Close layout options. Photo. Adult. Colon. Say something about this photo. Ellipsis. Text field.
So now we've got the standard kind of screen that you'd have when you're posting a status update on Facebook. So we've got the say something about this photo. We've further down, we've got buttons such as, you know, check in and tag people and all that kind of thing. But if we we're on the main text field now for putting the actual status. So if we flick to the right.
Photo. Adult. 7. Edit 5.
We've got the photo there and that little ping that you heard. And then the description that it started to do was voiceover's own description.
Edit photo. Button.
Edit photo.
Effects. Button. More button.
So now what we want to do is double tap on more.
More alert. Remove photo button. Edit photo button. Effects button. Edit all text button.
And here we go. Edit all text. So if we double tap that.
Cancel button.
Now what we've got here is a fairly similar screen to the one we had on Twitter, really. So if we flick around here.
Change alt text. Heading. Add alternative text that describes the contents of the photo for people with visual impairments. Text field. Done. Dimmed. Button. Done. Dimmed. Button.
And there we go. Obviously that done button is dimmed, but if that was, if we'd put some text in that alternative text field, then that button would become active and then we would just put in the description there, click done. And then when a screen reader user browses through Facebook and that photo appears on the newsfeed or in a group or whatever, the alt text description will be there. So that's how you add alt text to social media posts. As I said, other platforms should also have this functionality. I know Instagram definitely does. Not too sure about LinkedIn, but basically, when you're adding a photo, just have a look for something along the lines of descriptions or alt text or possibly something like more info. But usually it should be worded along those sorts of lines. So that's how you do it. And spread this information around, spread this info to your friends, your followers, make sure that they're aware of it. And if we all start using this feature and adding alt text to our content, then hopefully that will mean that we've got a much more accessible social media experience as blind people.
Thanks to Callum Stoneman there for his demonstration of how you go about adding alt text to images on social media. Callum joins us now. Callum, do you think more people are using alt text these days? What's the sort of your finger in the air kind of read of this situation?
I'm not sure. I think it is starting to become a bit more well known now. Twitter have added in the little alt text reminder that you can get. You know, I think that is doing a good job of raising awareness. I think the main thing that we need to focus on now is not so much using the alt text, but using it in the right way. I've seen a couple of instances where people have used it, because the thing with Twitter is there is a little icon now where you can actually see the alt text visually. It's not just visible to screen readers anymore. You can actually click on this little icon and see the alt text and read it. And I'm not sure. I think the reason they did that was to help people learn how to use it. But then I've seen some instances of accounts putting little hidden messages in there or putting in little jokes in there. So they'll have an image, but then instead of the alt text describing what the image is, they'll have some sort of hidden message in there, which obviously is not its purpose. So I think they're doing a good job of raising the awareness of alt text. I think now the next step is to kind of raise awareness of what exactly it is and when it's used and how best to use it.
Tasneem, what's been your experience? Do you think there's more or less alt text out there, and do you find it useful?
When I have seen it around on the web and, you know, social media, I do think it's particularly helpful. It's always helpful to have descriptions of images, especially if you're on a familiar site or reading sort of messages that you wouldn't normally be looking at. Or, you know, I think it's always useful to help. Anything that's going to improve the accessibility is a win for me, definitely.
Yeah, very important that these big companies like Twitter are speaking publicly about the importance of alt text. Well, we'd love to hear your experiences, good, bad or indifferent. And we hope you found Callum's demonstration of how to add alt text useful. Do let us know, perhaps record us a message or send us an email. You can do that too. techtalk@rnib.org.uk. That's techtalk@rnib.org.uk. Tasneem, Callum, thanks again.
Turn now to Dave's conversation with RNIB's accessible gaming specialist, Ben Green.
You've got a ton of information on your website about how to access various games. If you could pick one or two titles for somebody who hasn't experienced an accessible mainstream game, what would they be?
I mean, The Last of Us Part 2 is the obvious one. I'm not going to dwell too long on it because, you know, everybody has, in the sense of everyone has probably heard about how accessible it is. but that is a single player narrative, you know, story driven game. And with that, that's got so many accessibility options that not only was I able to complete it without sighted assistance on multiple occasions, including the hardest difficulty level, so grounded, and on a separate what we call permadeath run, so where if you die in the case of my run, you start at the beginning of the chapter, so it can set you back about 15-20 minutes of progress. That took me a while. But not only that, but I know sighted people, one of my collaborators in the States, has actually played through it blindfolded for their first run, which is an amazing thing to you know, take a leap of faith and do. Yes, of course you'll need a PS4 or 5 to play it, but that game is worth the investment for that. And of course, upcoming titles that will be coming to the PlayStation platform that are going to have a lot of accessibility, because there's a remake of the original Last of Us, which is going to have audio description for the cutscenes, and as well as a bunch of other options as well that we, you know, haven't seen in action yet, of course, but I'm very much looking forward to that in September. As for multiplayer, though, and to, you know, keep things fair, Xbox-wise, if you can get a crew together for either of these games, Gears 5 or Sea of Thieves. Gears 5 is a shooter which does have enough accessibility for you to be viable in multiplayer PvE, so player versus environment, where you're fighting AI-controlled enemies up to certain difficulty levels, as well as run through escape mode, which is a mode that I actually consulted on the accessibility feature for, navigation ping escape mode. And that's a really fun mode where three players go through tile-generated maps to escape a level. And that's a very fun one. Once you get into Gears and you understand how it works, it can be a great time. Sea of Thieves, similarly, is a crew-based game where you and up to three other players sail around on, you know, in a pirate ship, essentially. So you can sail around in ships built for two, three, or four people. Ideally, you'd want to sail around in a galleon, so that's for four. So it'd be you and three other sighted people giving you a hand where needed. You can have two gamers without sight on the same ship. I personally haven't tried that yet, but I've been meaning to. And once your crew know your limitations, how you play, you know, what you can do, what you feel you can't do, you know, then you can work from there. And I would be remiss if I didn't mention a fourth and final entry, which is As Dusk Falls on the Xbox side, which is a recently released choice-driven narrative adventure, decade-spanning, that released on the 19th of July this year, and is the first, to my knowledge, the first fully playable and fully accessible Xbox game on the platform in terms of a mainstream context. Because we've had games like The Veil, Shadow of the Crown, which is an audio-only title, but As Dusk Falls has full visuals and is playable start to finish, even if there are a few screen reader bugs that apparently need to be ironed out. So you've got a fair amount to choose from on both Xbox and on the PlayStation side as well.
When I told my 13-year-old son, who is sighted, by the way, not his fault, don't hold it against him, but you know, he's an Xbox gamer. You know, one of the things I've kind of struggled with since we've had Xbox is really knowing what titles would I be able to play with him, right? So, I mean, he does all sorts. You know, he plays like FIFA and, well, we'll get into simulators and things like that in a bit. But is there anything that you think would lend itself particularly well for a blind parent and a sighted teenager, or perhaps the other way around?
Well, there's a great, you've mentioned Xbox a few times in that, and there's a brilliant feature that a lot of people overlook, possibly because of the original marketing strategy, but maybe not. That's Co-Pilot on Xbox, which is essentially where two controllers can act simultaneously as one. So say you and I are in the same room, because that's the key thing with Co-Pilot. You have to be in the same room. We are in the same room. We have two controllers, and you and I are, you know, playing together. It's not so much that you are controlling a character, I'm controlling a different one. It is that you can say, move the character, and I can do the aiming and the shooting, for instance. And yeah, and that's a big part of, you know, my gaming when I've played stuff off stream. I completed Doom Eternal and the DLCs with that feature off stream with sighted assistance. And that was so much fun. It really was amazing. I mean, yeah, it sucks that I didn't have full agency. I couldn't do it myself.
I've done the co-pilot thing, but I just didn't find it very satisfying because a lot of the time it was my son telling me when to press stuff, you know? And so it's like, well, you don't actually need me here, do you? Like, I'm not getting a lot from the experience because I don't get to make any decisions of my own in that situation.
I feel like that might be down to the, possibly down to the games you're playing as well. Well, let's take Doom as an example. If I hear the audio cue for a cacodemon, I then yell to my co-pilot above the blasting surround sound. I'm like, cacodemon, grenades! and we go from there. And, you know, my co-pilot will line it up, and then I'll try and time it as best I can. If I don't hit it, then, you know, it's on me partially. But it's also, you know, then my co-pilots tend to apologize and be like, sorry, I missed it. Or even haptics. You know, with games like Horizon Zero Dawn, well, not Zero Dawn, Forbidden West, which has co-pilot on PS5, it's the only game that I know of to have it as of the time of recording, as a feature built into the game itself. I actually consulted on that. But that game was very good because I could, you know, I could tell when to dodge, I could tell when to heal, I could tell, you know, when things were recharging, all sorts of other small things that you wouldn't necessarily expect that then allow me a greater level of agency. And I think it's also a matter of your co-pilot, whoever that is, understanding what you want out of it and what you are capable of doing. So say you know there's an audio cue for, oh, I can, you know, jump here or whatever. You say there's an audio cue for this so I can hit this. And then your co-pilot says, fine, cool. You know, that's on you. That's your job. And
yeah. You know what I would like, Ben? I'd love like a little filter that I could use to be able to say, look, I'm a gamer without sight. I have a sighted co-pilot or I don't have a sighted co-pilot. Show me some games that would work for whichever of those scenarios I happen to be. You know, I could say, you know, I have some usable vision or no usable vision, or I have one controller, I have two controllers, you know. So it'd be great to be able to have that kind of ability to filter the long list of games that are available.
That feature does exist. It exists on Xbox at the very least through the accessibility meta tags, I think is what they called it, or accessibility filter tags. And you can filter based on accessibility features, which at the moment, of course, isn't necessarily much help because there aren't many games that are fully playable without sighted assistance. But it might help if you want to filter down by, say, genre or by if it's got good, I don't know, good contrast or whatever, if you were able to utilize that. You know, so there's definitely scope there and they are looking for feedback. And I think the best opportunity would be for you and anyone else who wants to be involved in things like that to apply to the Xbox Accessibility Insider League or the XAIL. If you Google XAIL, you know, you should be able to find it or put it into your search engine of choice. You should be able to find it.
Excellent. What led you to RNIB, Ben? It's great to have you here, but it sounds like you were making a difference out there on your own as a freelancer and as a consultant and putting out all this content and visiting studios and all of that. What led you to join RNIB?
Well, one of the first things is, I'm going to be brutal here, freelance consultancy work is irregular. It's sporadic. It doesn't happen necessarily as often as might make it fully viable. That's not to say I didn't enjoy it, not to say I didn't have fun with it, not to say the opportunities weren't amazing, but the fact of the matter is having a regular full-time position is definitely, you know, a positive asset. And it still also means that I can do what I did before. I can talk to studios. I can see what they're doing. I can consult if they need me. I can hand those opportunities off to other people as well, you know, if that's a thing they're interested in. But also as well, the RNIB side of it then gives me the backing of the charity as well. You know, much as I said in the Twitter reply that I put out when people ask me what my role entails, it's essentially, you know, consultancy, reviews, content, none of that's really going to change other than the scope of it might end up being bigger because, you know, there's the organisational backing of the RNIB to then raise awareness either of the content or the need for improvement, any of those kinds of things. And of course, I get to come and work for a fantastic team who've already very kindly been sort of showing me the ropes of the organization itself, because it is a big organization. And, you know, it's learning my way around. It's figuring out who to talk to for what, and, you know, various things like that. But it's very much, you know, an opportunity that I saw that would benefit both sides. You know, not only would it benefit me, but it hopefully would also be of benefit to the RNIB as well, because, you know, gaming brings everybody together under a common cause. And if that common cause is accessibility, all the better. So hopefully, you know, the work I end up doing will be able to get more people into gaming and discussing what needs to happen for them to be able to game with greater agency as well.
Your job title at RNIB isn't just about gaming. You mentioned possibly something bigger. I think your job title speaks about...
Accessible Gaming and Immersive Technologies Research Officer.
Right. Can you elaborate on the sort of the second part of that then, the immersive technologies? What does that mean and what are some of the challenges there?
So immersive tech really, at least in my view at present, encompasses things like VR, so virtual reality, which I've always said and I've always maintained, the V in VR does not stand for visual. And the reason being, I had the great opportunity to review an Oculus Rift a few years ago and also play Rock Band VR at Harmonix over in the States. And the thing that struck me was I could do it without assistance when the interface was accessible. And that's the big thing. Not only do the games have to be accessible, but the interface does as well, much like any other platform. But I've only ever played one fully accessible game in VR, and that was part of a research project. And that was last year. And VR's been around for a heck of a lot longer than that. It's been around since sort of the 90s, if not possibly earlier. And we want to see improvement in, you know, not just consoles, PC, handhelds. We want to see it in VR as well, because there's opportunities in VR that you just don't get from like traditional console gaming. So things like Beat Saber. I have a copy of Beat Saber, but I've never been able to really play it because learning the charts isn't as accessible because you need sighted assistance to do it. You know, I've had a chat even with people in, you know, the modding scene, and they think it's interesting. They think it's a good idea. It's then just a matter of getting it into the game, which is best done, of course, at a developer level and a publisher level as a standard. So, because, of course, you know, if you retrofit features in, they're going to cost a lot more. If you put it in right at the beginning, then it's going to be a lot easier and it's going to cost a lot less. So the fact of the matter is immersive tech is a growing industry, and it needs to be, you know, while it's still in its, even in its relatively early stages, you could argue, even though it has kind of kicked off with things like the Oculus Quest 2, it still needs to be considered that, you know, as people get older or as people, you know, are born with, you know, sight loss and whatever other disabilities, it needs to be accessible to everybody. You want everybody to join, you know, the VR community. That should be in, those features should be in place to allow that to happen. You know, narrated interfaces for the home screens, the menus, but also, of course, accessibility within the games themselves. So, you know, audio description for cutscenes, or, you know, traversal elements that are accessible, you know, in-game tutorials that are spoken, aiming, you know, with audio cues, all of these comparatively small additions that would be extremely helpful, not just for gamers with sight loss like myself or yourself as well, but to everybody, because everyone can benefit from accessibility features. That's the message we want to send. Everyone can benefit from accessibility. Subtitles is the classic one. Say you've got a person in the other room, you know, who's sleeping. You don't want to have the sound up too loud. What do? Turn the subtitles on. Read those. Even being able to adjust volumes of audio assets. So say the music's too loud and that's literally the only thing that's too loud. You want to be able to turn the music down slightly, not just on or off, but slightly. Being able to tweak ambience. You know, I could go on and on with this, but those features will help everybody. You might not think it now. You might not think it now, you might not think it tomorrow, but years down the line, for instance, you could have, you know, no sight, for instance, and you'd be thinking, I wanted to be able to play video games. And because of accessibility, you will be able to if it's done correctly and to a significant degree.
Well, Ben, I'm pretty sure we're going to be hearing from you again here on Tech Talk. And I thank you so much for your time in joining us and sharing with us. And do stay in touch. What's the best way for people to sort of get on your radar if somebody wants to kind of respond to anything that you've raised in this conversation?
The best places probably to do that would be through Twitter, Twitch, or YouTube. So I am Sightless Combat on all of those. So SIGHTLESSKOMBAT. And if you refer to me as Sightless Combat or SK on any of those platforms, I will gladly respond and answer whatever questions you have in terms of that, and pass things through internally as well if needs be, because you never know. You might raise a question that even I haven't thought of, and I could be like, this presents an interesting opportunity. So who knows, you may yet shape the future of RNIB's accessible gaming work as well.
Sightless Combat with a K, Ben Breen, thank you very much.
Thank you.
We're almost at the end of another Tech Talk, and if you have thoughts about smart canes, alt tags on images, or accessible gaming, we would very much love to hear from you about those things or anything else technology related. You can email techtalk@rnib.org.uk, techtalk@rnib.org.uk. It just remains for me to thank our co-hosts, Callum Stoneman and Tasneem Arshad. Appreciate your company again, guys. Cheers.
Bye for now.
Thank you. Same time next week.
Indeedy. We'll be back on RNIB Connect Radio next Tuesday at 1. And you can hear us again Thursday at 9 or wherever you get your podcasts. From me, Dave Williams, and the rest of the Tech Talk team. Until next time, bye for now.